Hi, this is Jeff Kober, and we welcome you to this Disney Insights podcast. Thanks for being a part. It seems hard to imagine that Disney's Hollywood Studios opened 35 years ago, the first park to open under the leadership of Michael Eisner. The Disney MGM Studios, as it was known then, has a storied past. How it got started, why it became the way it did, and how it competed with Universal Studios is the stuff of movie legend. Join us as we look at how an idea became Walt Disney World's third theme park, how it struggled to move from a half-day concept to a full-day park experience, how it came to add the MGM name, how it sought to imitate Universal Studios, and how Universal, in turn, sought to imitate Disney. And how the park was so popular in its first weeks of operation that it turned away guests even before, well, the park reached its official daily opening time. Join us as we learn lessons and insights from the opening of Disney MGM Studios 35 years ago. Also, make sure you check out, DisneyInsights.com, where we'll have some graphics and links to this article, show notes, and so forth. Also, you're going to want to, if you have an opportunity, go to your podcast subscriber, and if possible, give a positive rating or review, if you could. That kind of helps all those crazy algorithms out there and helps us to connect with other listeners who want to know more about the things that we're talking about here at Disney Insights. I also have to take a moment to say that 2 weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago, we had a podcast on the opening of the Disney Casting Center, again, 35 years ago, and there were some great responses from folks about their experience. Michelle wrote, "I was hired at the Casting Center in June of 1989. I remember that day like it was yesterday. I was 17 years old and selected for the MGM Studios when it opened in May. Climbing the ramp to apply was super nerve-wracking, but once I got to the waiting area, I was so excited about being part of the Disney legacy. They called my name and took me back for my interview and told me on the spot that I was being offered a role. I worked through high school, then college, and got to be a manager in the parks. Then full circle, I became a casting leader in 2000. This was a dream. I loved the building's magic, and cast there was among the best I've worked with in my career. I loved every minute of my Disney career, but casting is just special. I learned so much about Disney's approach to hiring and techniques to optimize selection. I continue to use these practices in my role outside of Disney. A favorite is a standard requirement using the acronym CAST, which, by the way, we talk about in the podcast. This meant a candidate must be receptive to compensation, which back then was $7.10, appearance, no facial hair or tattoos back then, schedule, and transportation. This could be adjusted for your company, but it's a game changer, particularly in a virtual work setting." So thank you for sharing that, Michelle. Cheryl noted something I did not know about, which was the cow. The cow, which was a customized RV that, as an acronym, stood for Casting on Wheels, was a unique approach that they took to going out to specialty marketing market programs and to find individuals in hard-to-fill roles. So high school students, senior citizens, targeted community events. The cow's not around anymore, but oh my goodness, what concepts and ideas. David said, "I was a casting intern in the early mid-90s. Remember the welcome film in which we would banter back and forth with the characters? We would often find people sitting in the audience with no intention of ever even working at Disney." I guess that film kind of got word out that people wanted to check out the casting center. At any rate, thanks for those who shared. And I think if you have an opportunity, as we talk about your experience, maybe working at Disney's Hollywood Studios or even visiting those first few months or the first year of operation, please feel free to share. There's so much to learn from the building of Disney MGM Studios. It begins really with the power of a good idea. With energy and success in film, television, and even video, Michael Eisner, the new CEO of the Walt Disney Company, set out to put his signature on the theme parks. On his first trip to WED Imagineering, Ray Watson, who as a board member had been influential about Eisner and Wells coming on board, was assigned to drive them there. But he got lost on the way to the Glendale offices, an omen that this part of Disney had been off the radar for some time. Even employees at 1401 Flower Street were thinking that they were about to be laid off. But Michael loved the imagination and creative thinking of this team, and he saw possibilities right and left. They saw the people at Imagineering as, quote, the crown jewel of the organization. They assured the team of that on Monday, and then the next Saturday, Eisner brought his sons to walk through several concepts Imagineering had been working on. His boys thought a concept of a steep flume ride based on Song of the South would be huge fun. Michael saw big possibilities in teaming up with forces like George Lucas, Michael Jackson, and Francis Ford Coppola in creating a 3D rock film, and specifically with Lucas, a simulator ride based on Star Wars, which, by the way, just a couple of weeks ago premiered a new version of that attraction. It has just continued to be successful for so many years. Anyway, but all of these were single hits, and Michael was looking more for a home run. On their first tour of Walt Disney World, he and Wells noticed that Epcot explored many themes, but none to do with entertainment. Bob Weiss, who would go on to head up the studio's project, quoted Eisner, who had said, "You know, at Epcot, you got the energy business, you got the transportation business, you have all these things, but you don't have the entertainment business. So why don't we have a pavilion at Epcot that's about our business?" Imagineers early on pitched an idea that would celebrate film, television, and radio, and would be housed between Kodak's Journey into Imagination and Kraft's Land Pavilion. In fact, an image of that, which is kind of a theater marquee entrance in front of a painted studio backdrop, and it was actually done by our famed Disney legend to be Joe Rohde. That concept was the first one that apparently Michael saw. And when Michael saw it, he sensed something much bigger than the three attractions, which actually ultimately became the Great Movie Ride for film, Superstar Television for TV, and Monster Sound Show for radio. Now, initially, I actually thought that it was only the Great Movie Ride that was presented, but actually there were three attractions that were going to be inside that entertainment pavilion. Michael saw an entire theme park, and with it a working movie studio similar to what folks were experiencing at Universal Studios in Hollywood. Could this be a brand new park, maybe a half-day park? The concept truly spoke to a new page in Disney's theme park history. By February 1985, at the shareholders meeting, with only 4 months into his tenure, Eisner announced the intent to build a studio tour in Florida. And apparently, somewhere around that same time, I saw an image the other day of Eisner meeting with the governor in Tallahassee and doing the same presentation. I found that fascinating as well. At any rate, the one problem that plagued everyone as they contemplated these three attractions, much less an entire park, well, Disney had leveraged its IP, its intellectual property, from Snow White, an attraction like Snow White's Scary Adventures, to the Black Cauldron, which was Disney's more recent film. Gurgies, Munchies, and Crunchies was actually a place in Fantasyland at the park. But while some properties like Mary Poppins, Fantasia, and Herbie the Love Bug needed attention still, there wasn't enough of Disney IP to go around. The best new star on Disney's lot was Roger Rabbit, whose film premiere in 1988 was widely and critically acclaimed. But there wasn't much time between that success and the park's opening to actually do something. Moreover, a concept like the Great Movie Ride needed much, much more. A superstar television show needed to showcase more than just the Golden Girls, which had already taken off at the studio. And while progress was being made in the first years, Disney was still the bottom of the studio barrel. They needed to borrow some great moments from other movies, not just showcase theirs. At the same time, the greatest Hollywood studio for decades was now bleeding losses, and the man put in charge of MGM, now MGM UA, Frank Rothman, was actually an old lawyer friend of Frank Wells. A call was made where the MGM Frank was really about to plead with the Disney Frank to not move their lab work from MGM UA over to 20th Century Fox. But the window gave Wells an opportunity to explore use of the MGM name in connection with Disney. MGM had a strong brand with films like Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, and Singing in the Rain. In short order, 4 months actually, an agreement was signed and Walt Disney World had a name for its newest theme park, Disney MGM Studios. The use of other characters and licenses would be added, from Tarzan to Indiana Jones at the Great Movie Ride, and from Gilligan's Island to the bar in Cheers at Superstar Television. Part of what would be the appeal of Disney MGM Studios would be seeing an active working studio, just like Universal Hollywood. So a major backstage tour with a walking tour portion was incorporated into the plan. World-class sound stages were built and where guests could walk through and look on production of the new Mickey Mouse Club or participate costumed up in Let's Make a Deal. On board a tram, guests would go down Residential Street and see Herbie the Love Bug parked in the driveway next to the home of the Golden Girls. Then they would be carted off to be part of a harrowing special effects experience known as Catastrophe Canyon. It too borrowed ideas from the tram tour at Universal that featured events like an earthquake and a flash flood. These concepts perfectly borrowed from Hollywood Universal's tour and completed the notion of a new theme park at Walt Disney World. And that ticked off Universal to no end. After all, Universal wanted to come to Orlando. Now, no question, Universal led for decades the idea of visiting Hollywood Studio. Therefore, why not replicate the formula in Orlando, where Disney had established a successful kingdom? But this was not Hollywood, and while Disney partnered in the early years with others like SeaWorld to present a solid Central Florida vacation option, what was always clear from the beginning was that Disney was the first to establish Orlando as the vacation kingdom of the world. Disney had no intention of sitting back and letting Universal do a studio park in Orlando on their own. What's not stated so clearly is the degree that Eisner had been exposed to Universal's plan to find the financing for over a 3-year period to build that theme park in Orlando. There are clearly different opinions on this, but sources do say that Sid Sheinberg of Universal reached out to Eisner after Michael came on board with Disney to build a park together. Eisner announced that there were already plans on the table, and that did not sit well with Sheinberg, who felt Disney was invading Universal's realm. Sid said to a reporter, quote, "Do you really want a little mouse to become one large ravenous rat?" To say the least, Universal was livid. So fixated was this rivalry between them that Eisner himself acknowledged that he and his assistant, Art Leavitt, climbed over the Universal construction fence at about 3 o'clock in the morning at one point to see how much dirt had actually been moved. All they found was a construction permit and a security guard walking toward them. They scrambled to get out of there quickly. Speaking of quickly, Disney moved quickly on the studios by doing three things. First, they made the park a half-day park. In contrast to the sprawl of Epcot, which had huge cost overruns, the initial thought was that a half-day park would create an opportunity to seize the day with guests checking in or out of their hotels on the first or last day. The park's offering was designed with that in mind, though by opening day, the ticket cost the same as the two other parks, and while it was designed as a half-day park, it wasn't marketed by that time to guests. And by the way, I should also note that during the same time, Disney's Typhoon Lagoon and Pleasure Island, which we'll talk about on an upcoming podcast in the next couple of months, they also sought to gather per cap from guests arriving or departing Orlando on that first or last day. So this was plan one. Don't make a big park, just make a half-day park. Step two, utilize Reedy Creek Improvement District. While this governing jurisdiction was independent from Disney, it was made of people who were formerly Disney employees and who knew what was needed to get the job done. Some might call that customer service, some might call that bending the rules a little bit. That allowed permits and plans to go through very quickly. Indeed, construction moved so quickly that some claimed that inspections occurred after the building was completed and not before. In fact, actually, it was ABC News that did a 2020 special on Disney and how they were doing some things like this. And they charged Dick Nunes and others at Disney about this. This was before ABC actually was bought by Disney. And in fact, you can't find this video anymore. I have it recorded, but I could tell you that ABC has no interest in showing that video again. It was pretty demeaning toward Disney at the time. Well, so that was step two, utilize the Reedy Creek Improvement District to get out of the gate. Because what happened for Universal is that it took a lot longer for them to go through, well, the traditional steps of working with the county or the city in order to get the inspections and permits that they needed. The third thing that Disney did is they followed the Universal Hollywood model of a, quote, behind the scenes tram style tour. While Disneyland flourished as a uniquely designed theme park, Universal Hollywood also did well north of town, but not as a theme park per se, but as a studio tram tour plus. According to Sam Genaway's book, Universal vs. Disney, The Unofficial Guide to American Theme Park's Greatest Rivalry, the tram tour idea came when Albert Dorskind of Universal was at Farmers Market in Los Angeles, and he saw buses bringing tourists into Farmers Market. He considered the possibility of having Grey Line buses drive through the back lot and then drop tourists off at the studio commissary where they could dine with the stars. Eventually, Universal secured their own trams and dropped the Grey Line buses. In time, other attractions like a makeup or stunt show were added, largely to kind of hold guests while they were waiting in line for the tram tour. I remember the first time I took the tram tour, you got actually in line for something akin to a return pass, not a fast pass per se, but a return pass where you had to then come back about 2 hours later to board the tram because there was nothing else to board or to ride on. And so you'd wander around and see the stunt show or visit the gift shops and whatnot. As mentioned earlier, Disney saw the benefits of borrowing from that Universal model. So beyond the film, television, radio attractions they initially created or designed, the big bulk of the studio was a tram walking tour that ultimately left you at the entrance of their animation tour which was the thing that kind of made Disney distinct. At a stunt show like Universal with Indiana Jones, and within the first year, the Star Tours attraction, which had been hugely successful at Disneyland, and suddenly you had a new, though half-day park. Newsweek ran a cover story about the park called Mickey's New Magic, but the park itself was frankly more patterned after Universal's magic. Curiously, Universal had also had a tram tour in mind when they came to Orlando, but it was nothing compared to its Hollywood namesake. Actually, it closed a few years later. Instead, it focused on ride-style attractions like Disney, but on themes based on Jaws, King Kong, Back to the Future, and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Because they didn't have easy permit approvals, and because they didn't have proven expertise in building theme park attractions, Universal Orlando, called Universal Studios Escape initially, wouldn't open until June of 1990, giving Disney over a year to successfully operate. And even then, so many attractions had to be fixed or improved upon. But hey, build it and they will come, right? Technically, that phrase shared in Field of Dreams is not build it and they will come. It's actually, quote, if you build it, he will come. Ironically, that film was released the same year as Disney's Hollywood Studios, and also, ironically, the film was made by Universal. For Disney, reception of the new park was instantaneous and massive. For months after opening, the park would close early to guests. To address the issue, they would unofficially open the park earlier and then close later. But that brought so many guests into the park prior to opening that often the park reached its maximum before its officially stated opening time. Guests were confused as they drove into the parking lot. To remedy this, large spaces or gaps were created in the parking lot so as to look at like it was filled when the lot actually wasn't, but the park was. It was an operational nightmare, but the kind of nightmare Disney was open to having and marketing. I remember that my first visit to Disney MGM Studios came in January after the May. So it was well into operation. But as I approached in my rental car, Walt Disney World, there were signs out to the side saying that the park was closed. It was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The park was closed and they were detouring me to Epcot. In the end, what I actually ended up doing was spending time at Epcot. The Wonders of Life had just opened, so I got a chance to check that out. And then I came over to the studios about 3:30, 4 p.m. That was actually kind of fortunate because there had been a rainstorm and the rain had cleared by then. But that gives you an idea of just how popular, months after opening, they were having to close the park early. Part of that, of course, was because it really was only a half-day park. In short order, between the need to handle a greater volume of guests and compete with Universal, Eisner, within 3 months after opening, announced a major expansion that would double the size of the park over the next few years. Sunset Boulevard and the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror were a part of that, and when animation features like The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and Beauty and the Beast became studio box office hits, they found a home at Disney MGM Studios. You'll recall that at the time of opening, none of these new classic films had come out, and so they were just depending on older films like Great Mouse Detective and The Black Cauldron. So these were huge in contributing to the expansion of the Disney MGM Studios. But before that happened, Disney was still feeling the need for more IP. And so it made its first overture not just partnering, but in the acquisition of Jim Henson Studios. Henson's own untimely death and the politics of the studio would kill the deal off until many years later. but it set the stage for acquisitions, first with ABC, then later under Bob Iger's leadership with Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, and 20th Century Fox. By that time, who needed to pay for the MGM name? The park would be renamed as Disney's Hollywood Studios. Two side notes on this, by the way. Universal's own contractual arrangements with Marvel before its Disney acquisition would make it difficult for Disney to do much of anything at Walt Disney World with big Marvel names such as Captain Marvel or Iron Man. But the initial conversation between Bob Iger and George Lucas about Disney's acquisition of Lucasfilm actually came one morning when the two had a private breakfast at the park's Brown Derby restaurant. That's when the new sequence of Star Tours and different scenarios that you would arbitrarily go to, that's when that first came out. And that actually occurred right there at Disney's Hollywood Studios. According to Eisner, within a month after opening, Disney's stock went up more than 20%. In 1989, well before Universal opened up, attendance rose by more than 5 million visits the first half of the year and by another 3.5 million later on in the year. By the end of 1990, operating income from the park had reached $800 million, significantly higher than the $250 million when Eisner first arrived in 1984. Most importantly, the notion of spending an entire vacation in Walt Disney World had actually been achieved. Universal would get out the gate in 1990 and then struggle along with Disney in 1991 as the Gulf War and an economic recession loomed. The tides of success would ebb and flow for both parks over the years, but one thing was made certain. A rising tide lifts all boats. And with Universal in Orlando, that has been the case over many decades. In his biography, Eisner would rephrase General Sarnoff's quote by saying, "Competition brings out the worst in people and the best in products." Now, like many of these unique Disney Insights podcasts, we bring you free ideas for the next century. Free souvenirs for you and your organization. So consider the following questions, as you think about the stories that I've actually shared here, think about how you can make the magic alive, come alive for you and your organization. First off, what sources provide you inspiration? Where do they come from? Second, what best practices can be bought or maybe stolen from others? Which ones maybe shouldn't be borrowed or stolen? Well, how can you be ahead of the competition? That's the big question. Rather than be the competition by simply mirroring them, what strategies do you have in place to actually grow your organization once you get out the gate? Who could you link up with to expand and build upon your own brand? And does competition bring out better products and services in your field? Can you even do it without bringing out the worst in people? These are just a couple ideas to think about as we consider the experience of Disney MGM Studios opening 35 years ago. Well, thank you for joining us for this Disney Insights podcast. We appreciate your participation. If you want to know more about these kinds of stories, check out my books, such as, A Century of Powerful Disney Insights and Disney Leadership and You. All these give you sense of ideas and concepts that you can actually apply back to your organization. And if you want more, join our Patreon group, the Wayfinder Society, because there, oh my goodness, there are so many additional tools and interactive resources that you can, as well as some podcasts that you can listen to. So check out the Patreon, our Patreon group known as the Wayfinder Society. Again, thanks for joining us in the words of Sinbad Storybook Voyage at Tokyo Disney. Always follow the compass of your heart. Have a great day. We'll see you real soon.